I think the thing about Maitreya, I believe I'm one of three people in the order that has a Maitreya sadhana. So Maitreya is my yidam. And mostly people know absolutely nothing about Maitreya. And yet he is on our refuge tree. And yet Maitreya is recognised by every Buddhist school that there is, you know, including the Theravadins and the Hinayana schools. He's a figure that is included in their reverence alongside the historical Buddha. So, you know, he's such an amazing, gorgeous, beautiful figure and so unknown and yet so central to our refuge tree. And the reason why he's fitting on this particular weekend is that what he particularly embodies is our potential. So when I was introduced to Maitreya, this was me coming along to Sheffield Buddhist Centre in 2005. And it was Sangha Day, and Vajratara said, "Now we're going to chant to Maitreya because he's the Buddha of the future and you are all the Buddhas of the future." And from that moment, his mantra would not leave me alone. but it is that, you know, it's like there's Maitreya as the Buddha of the future. And that can be taken very literally. And actually, if you look in Theravadin sources, it is taken very literally. There's all these calculations about exactly when, in how many eons of kalpas, Maitreya is going to pop up. It's like the early Christian debates about the exact date of Easter. and yet, actually, what is the figure of Maitreya really getting at? It is getting at, actually, when conditions allow, enlightenment experience just wants to emerge. It's like it can erupt at any moment, at any place, in any person, in any time, whenever the conditions allow. So we've got Maitreya. So for yesterday we had the empty shrine. And today we have Maitreya with a veil over him. There's this whole thing about like presence and absence. It's like when there's an absence of the transcendent, well, what does that mean? Well, that means that there's the potential for the transcendent to erupt at any moment, any moment. So this is Maitreya as Buddha of the future. It's like Maitreya as the potential for awakening to appear in the universe. So that's what we're going to be exploring. Om Maitri, Maha Maitri, Maitri Swaha. So the form we have depicted there is a common Indo-Tibetan form, and that's the form that I practice and what I'm going to be talking about. But you can kind of see that because Maitreya spread basically to all the Buddhist countries, actually, like, there are many, many forms of Maitreya, from, like, you know, the sort of fat laughing Buddha of, you know, sort of folk culture in China, to warrior kings in Korea, and, you know, actually he sort of morphed into quite a few different forms. Yes. Okay, yeah. So this is Maitreya as described in the White Lotus Sutra. So this mystic light, this Buddha at the time of the White Lotus Sutra, teacher of the Dharma, at that time had a pupil who was always of a lazy spirit, greedily attached to fame and gain, tireless in seeking fame and gain, addicted to enjoyment in noble families, casting aside that which he learnt, forgetting everything, and dull of apprehension, who because of these things was called fame seeker. He also, by practicing good works, was enabled to see numberless Buddhas, also to pay homage to Buddhas, and to follow them, walking the great way, perfecting the six paramitas, and now has seen Shakya, the lion. He will afterward become a Buddha, and will be called Maitreya, who shall widely save living creatures, countless in number. Now, I just love this, because basically it just tells you what a totally rubbish practitioner he was. And I don't know, I mean, I've never actually seen a description of Avalokiteshvara or Manjushri, like just expressing what a really terrible practitioner they were at some point in the past. Whereas, you know, with Maitreya, you know, this is sort of pointed out with gusto, you know, casting aside that which he learned, forgetting everything, dull of apprehension, called fame seeker. I just love it. And it just expresses something about what Maitreya is, which is like, Maitreya is like our process of enlightening. In the Gandavyuha Sutra, I've noticed that it translates, I think it's translating Bodhisattva as enlightening being. And I just really love that, because what it is it's talking about like us in the process of enlightening. And actually, it doesn't all look kind of nice and slick and we always do the right thing and, oh, well, we've learned the precepts, so we always act by them. And it's kind of saying, and how we are is messy, and the process doesn't always look ideal. Whereas you read stuff about the historical Buddha, and actually, like, it probably was quite messy for the Buddha as well, but that isn't what we get in the stories, isn't it? That isn't what we get in the Pali Canon. You know, we get this great lion, this perfected being, that walks around India with this kind of presence of awareness and love. And you don't get a sense of kind of, well, what did that look like in the process? There's one Jataka I particularly love. Okay, this is so not in my notes, but it is kind of relevant. It's where the Buddha is an ascetic and he's a meditative practitioner and he's a really powerful practitioner who's getting into all sorts of very, very deep meditative states, and he becomes able to fly. And so one night he's flying around the city and there are all these towers. And because the towers are high up, they're not screened. And as he flies past the towers, he sees a beautiful lady undressing. And he's overcome with lust. And so all his powers desert him and he falls out the sky and he's killed. And that's the end of that life.
That's the way to go.
So that's the sort of thing I find really inspiring. Yeah. Okay, right. Back to my tray. Yes. So with my tray, you've got this kind of, you know, in a sense, you have this archetype who is the Buddha of the future, who is always waiting to emerge at every moment. You know, whenever conditions allow, Maitreya will pop up. And so you might sort of think, okay, so what is that in your experience? When does a transcendent moment just pop up? And for me, very often, it's not when I expect it. I don't think, oh, yes, I'm planning a transcendent moment for like 20 past 10. Quite often, it's when I least expect it. And it can also be not at a classically spiritual moment. So, I mean, certainly it sort of can be when it's like I'm on retreat and I'm in a really, really good state. But mostly at that point, I wander around in a really, really good state and drink tea. But sometimes it's like the transcendent moment, it kind of pops up I don't know, maybe I've just been in a really vile mental state and snapped at somebody, and then it's like I go into another room and suddenly it's like, oh, something happens where like the rain's against the window and all the drops are running down the window and something else happens, and it's just like, oh, I see my own bondage. It's like I see actually that doesn't need to happen. You know, something else is possible. Or I think moments of shock, I mean, bereavement is a very, very obvious one, where it's just like suddenly what is important, it's just like resonating out of, you know, the car park as you go to kind of pay your ticket in the hospital car park. And suddenly, like, you know, on a really deep level, what's important and what's not important. And that is Maitreya sort of like emerging into experience and just saying, yes, this, you know, this is how it is. This is what's important. So the figure of Maitreya, he's very, very often depicted and described as rising like the dawn sun against mountains. So he's in Akshobhya's family. Usually he can be Virochana's family, but it's this like everything is dark. You can't see where you're going. You're cold. You're lost. You're miserable. And then you get that proverb, don't you, about how it's darkest before dawn. And like the night, it can feel endless. And yet, every day, the sun comes up again. It's like every day, a dawn comes. And, you know, the sun rising against mountains. I don't know if anyone's been in mountains when the sun is rising, but it's like, It comes up, and first you just get this sort of bluey-grey light in the sky. And then colour starts to come into the world. It's like, you know, just very, very gradually the world goes from being sort of monochrome, kind of greys and blacks. And then you get this sort of rosy glow, and you can see, oh yes, that's green, that's blue, that's, you know, that's rocky and rough. And the clarity of the world starts announcing itself. And the dawn sun rises and it touches you and it's warm and you can see where you're going. You can see, oh, I am surrounded by mountains, but there's the path, and how beautiful they are. How beautiful. And again, very often in depictions of Maitreya, he'll have his aura, but also he'll have all these like rays of the sun kind of radiating from his heart. So this is where his seed syllable is, just radiating in all directions. You know, the sun doesn't choose, does it? It's like the sun rises and everything is touched, everything is illumined, everything is warmed. You know, clarity is given to everything. There's no picking, there's no choosing. And he's the archetype of the young king. So the traditional descriptions say 16 years old. And with Maitreya, like, it really does feel like that, like he's a youth. And again, the archetype here is it's of newness emerging into the world, kind of erupting into the world. And I think the archetypal stories around this, it's things like it's like the young King Arthur. Or Luke Skywalker, actually, would be another one, like, you know, the last of the Jedi. You know, it's like the Jedi are dying out. There's, you know, the spiritual values don't exist in the world anymore. And then Luke Skywalker steps onto the screen, and you know, the same with Arthur. So yeah, Uther Pendragon is ill. He's dying. The Saxon wolves are invading Britain. There's rape, there's pillage. you know, it's going to be a dark age where nothing is safe. And then no one knows about Arthur, and there's this sword in the stone, and Arthur, you know, and all the, you know, all the knights are trying to pull this sword out, but no. And then this young squire, who isn't even supposed to be like part of it, just sort of like pops up totally unexpectedly and thinks, oh dear, my knight needs a sword. Right, let's take him this one. Again, it's this sort of surprise aspect. You don't expect Maitreya. You never expect the transcendent to sort of suddenly erupt into your life. And yet it does from its own side. It's like it's got its own dynamic and it just wants to kind of appear in our lives. Even when we haven't invited it. So Maitreya is also the bodhisattva of metta or Maitri, which also makes me think, it's so fundamental. How come Maitreya isn't like, you know, how come every other Maitreya puja isn't to Maitreya? You know, metta, how more fundamental can you get? There's a story, a traditional story, about how Maitreya gets his name, which is loving one or friendly one. And the story is that once, long, long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, you can tell I like Star Wars, can't you? There was a spiritual practitioner, and he was living in a city, and he was just living in a fairly ordinary way in this city. And every day what he'd do is he'd go and he'd sit in meditation at the gates of the city. And this was where, you know, this would be like the busiest part, where everyone had to sort of like crowd in and funnel through, you know, all the travellers, the merchants, families, kings, warriors, you know, you name it, they had to be, you know, donkeys, whatever, would be coming and going through the city gates. And you can imagine the racket. And that is where Maitreya chose to sit and meditate. And he would sit there and he would do metta practice. And it said that everyone who passed through the city gates, it's like they could feel his metta, they could just feel this love emanating from Maitreya, and so they called him the loving one or the friendly one. So you can see that Maitreya sits on a throne, so again we've got more kind of king symbolism and the lions, this is all kind of royal. And sometimes he's described as being either in the Tushita heaven if you're a Theravadin, or in a Pure Land if you're a Mahayanist, and kind of waiting to appear in the world. But it can also be described as, you know, he's like, the throne is kind of like right in the middle of the world, engaged with the world, and both his feet are down. So Green Tara, like she's stepping, you know, she's sort of putting one leg down. Well, Maitreya has both feet down. Like, just look at his feet. Arloka did such beautiful feet. You know, it's like they're grounded. They're right here. They're in the world. Maitreya is always this close to us. You know, he's not somewhere else in the middle of a blue sky. It's like he's here. He's our breath. He's our bones. You could not be closer to Maitreya. He's like always right here in the middle of things, wanting to emerge. And you can see this in other stories about Maitreya. So you might bring to mind the story about Asanga. So how Asanga goes to a cave and he meditates for 3 years on Maitreya, and he just wants to get a vision of Maitreya. And he completely fails. There's a lot of failure in stories about Maitreya. And he gives up and he thinks, blow this for him, game soldiers, and starts walking off down the hill. And then, I forget the order, but what he sees, I don't know, a wing of a bird brushing a rock. And he thinks, and that will wear it down in time. So he goes back and he meditates for another 6 years, hoping for a vision of Maitreya. No vision of Maitreya. He goes down the hill, hopeless and despondent. And again, he sees something where he thinks, no, there's persistence. I can go back. So he goes back to his cave for another 3 years. Still no vision of Maitreya. And this time he really just thinks, you know what, 12 years. If he hasn't popped up in 12 years, I think I'm on a loser here. So he goes back down the hill and he walks into the village. And he sees the dog with maggots. And it's got this open sore and the maggots are eating the dog's flesh. And he can't bear to see the suffering of the dog. But equally, he can't bear to kill the maggots. So he takes his knife and he cuts a slice of his own leg and deposits the maggots with his tongue in order not to harm them on the piece of his own leg. I love this sort of thing. he obviously doesn't know that maggots only eat rotting flesh. But anyway. And it's so disgusting, he thinks he's going to throw up and he has to shut his eyes. And then when he opens his eyes, there is Maitreya. And it's like Maitreya has arisen, again, at the unexpected moment. You know, just at the moment. And also, it's a giving up moment. It's like he's given up. He's like, I've tried really, really hard to be spiritual all these years and I've really done it. And then he gives up. And there is Maitreya. And then he walks through the town and he tries to say to everyone, look, here is Maitreya, and no one can see Maitreya, and only an old woman can see the dog. So we've got Maitreya as engaged in the world and sort of like appearing when we are engaged in the world, and unexpectedly when we are engaged in the world. And, he's this bodhisattva in Akshobhya's family, or Varochna, and it's like you've got wisdom as this quality, you know, this kind of, you know, the amazing mirror-like wisdom of Akshobhya, or the Dharmadhatu wisdom of Varochna. And then, well, what does that look like when it gets into the world? Like, what does that look like as a human being walking around? Well, actually, it looks like an ordinary act of care, an ordinary act of kindness. It just looks like everyday friendliness in the world. So Maitreya is teaching the Dharma. So his hands are in the teaching mudra, like this, which I could say things about, but I won't in the interests of time. But I will say, this mudra, it's like you've got your right hand facing out, and that's compassion. You've got your left hand facing in, and that's wisdom. Clearly, I'm going to say. and then you're holding, like, I don't know, shunyata, and you hold it to your heart. It's like you're holding what is most precious to your heart. And then Maitreya is teaching because he's not keeping it to himself. It's like, in a sense, like, what does Maha Maitri, you know, what does transcendental love want for deluded beings wandering around in the world, causing themselves and others suffering, you know, like, yeah, Maha Maitri, you know, the expression of love is to teach the Dharma. How could it be otherwise? It's, you know, he's just saying, light is pouring out of his heart. He's teaching. His emblems are the wheel. So he's got a wheel on a lotus at one shoulder and a vase on the other shoulder. And the wheel is all the exoteric teachings, you know, everything you can explain, the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Six Paramitas, everything you can tell people. And that wheel, he's just sending that wheel rolling on. And the vase, it's the esoteric. And so Maitreya is also trying to give us moments of direct realization, moments where we know for ourselves, oh, this is interconnectedness. Separation does not make sense. That isn't how it is. When you have water poured over you, as some people will know quite recently, it's a very direct experience. It's like you know the sensation of water sliding over your skin. So Maitreya embodies our potential, a path of friendliness, and it also embodies a path of wisdom and a path of faith. So we've already seen how the wisdom, it's like wisdom emerging in the world, looking like love. And this sort of clarity of Maitreya's light and the teaching aspect. I just find it very, very interesting that he embodies metta and he is in the Vajra family. So it's like, what does metta look like from a Vajra perspective? And that is what Maitreya is trying to kind of show us. It's like he's Vajra, he's erupting unexpectedly. It's this sort of Vajra quality. And in that depiction, he's got Akshobhya on his head, but in many depictions, he has a stupa on his head. And it shows how it can go both ways with this path of faith and path of wisdom, which, you know, in a sense, are not so separate. So the stupa can be the six elements. And this is me going multiple ways internally. Stick to one way, Maitreya. Yeah, okay, so it can embody the six elements. And another text where Maitreya is really... we're in the Gandavyuha Sutra, Varochana's Tower. Okay. So you've got Sudana the Pilgrim, again, an enlightening being going through a process. And he's been meeting all these different spiritual friends, all these different bodhisattvas. Maitreya is the enlightening being who opens the door to him of Varochana's Tower. I think I'll leave that bit. So we've got wisdom and then we've also got faith. So the stupa can also be faith because Maitreya has Shakyamuni on his head. He's reverencing and revering the historical Shakyamuni and also like that impermanence. And you know how in a lot of the Mahayana sutras, it seems to be that a real question is about the life of the Buddha. How could the Buddha die? And, you know, Maitreya is sort of embodying the answer to that, where it's like you're revering all the occasions where a human or, you know, human level consciousness has become awakened. And you are yourself in a process of awakening. There's a text called Maitreya's Prayer, which describes him as having a total path of faith, where you know, Shakyamuni, he did all these ascetic things and he practiced really, really hard and it was all really, really difficult and he had to give up his wife and his kings and his counsellors and his body and his bone marrow, and it goes through all this kind of like list of things that that Shakyamuni had to renounce. And then it says, well, Maitreya took the easy path, the easy method, the easy vehicle. And three times in the day and three times in the night, he went down on one knee and he bows. And then he recites this prayer, which is essentially the first half is a puja. And the second half is an aspiration to practice the paramitas. Now, it doesn't say he actually has to practice them. All he has to do is say the prayer three times in the day and three times in the night. And this is the way in which he becomes a Buddha, by taking the easy vehicle, the easy path, the easy method. Okay, so I think I'll finish this with reading you a little bit out of the Gandavyuha Sutra. Of course, that thing about Virochana's tower, Sudhana steps into Virochana's tower and it's like a TARDIS, and Virochana's tower is vast, it is limitless. And in every direction, Sudhana can see towers and other towers reflected, and in each of them is a Sudhana. And yet none of the towers impede any of the other towers. You know, it's a direct realisation of interconnectedness. But before Maitreya opens the door to that tower, he rejoices in Sudhana. He rejoices in the practitioner, in the process of coming to enlightenment. And this is what he says. So I've changed the pronouns to she because we're she's. Born of the dragon of the mind of enlightenment, ascended into the sky of reality, reigning the teachings everywhere, she fosters all good fruits. She will light the lamp of truth, the pure wick, dispelling the darkness of defilement. The lamp in a strong vessel of love and awareness, glowing with the pure flame of the spirit of enlightenment. From the embryo of the aspiration for enlightenment, compassion and love. Gradually developing the limbs of enlightenment, this baby Buddha is growing. She will develop the embryo of virtue and clarify the path of knowledge. She is recognized as an embryo of knowledge, developed in accord with the womb of vows. When Maitreya had rejoiced in Sudhana in this way, he respectfully circumambulated the enlightening being, Maitreya, and said, "Please open the door of the tower, and I will enter."